You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. My name is Michael Silverblatt. Today my guest is Paul Theroux, the author, most recently, of My Other Life. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. He's published more than 30 books. The most recent others have been Milroy the Magician, Chicago Loop, My Secret History, Ozone. He is, of course, well known for St. Jack, The Family Arsenal, The Council's File, and his wonderful travel books, The Great Railway Bazaar, The Old Patagonian Express, so many. This book seems to me to be a very methodical exploration of separation from the past, from oneself, from one's wife, from one's characters, and examining separation in every register, the naturalistic, the supernatural, the domestic. And I wondered what brings you, because it almost seems like a meditation on the relationship between fiction and the self.
Well, that's actually fairly an astute analysis of it being about separation. And certainly when you say meditation, though, I know the readers are thinking not a lot of laughs in there. but I like to think of it as a book that has a lot of wit, and in which each piece has a beginning, a middle, and an end, though maybe not in that order. But I think that the nature of separation is the nature of being a writer. You feel, a writer does feel very separate, very alienated from, I think, the things he or she from the society that he or she is living in, and even the notion that a writer is a physical being, but rather inconsiderable physical being, someone that you could walk by and not even look at. And I mean, somewhat anonymous person. I was in a hotel today. We're in Los Angeles. And I was walking into the hotel, and Gina Davis came out. She's very tall. She was smiling. She has short blonde hair. And she said, "Thank you," in a very, you know, exuberant way to the guy opening the door for her. And I thought, that's amazing. I'm a little cockroach creeping past this huge, statuesque, wonderful person, this brilliant, radiant person who is a person. And I'm not a person. I'm simply looking at it. I'm walking by, and no one sees me. I find that interesting. I'm glad. I find it very restful to be anonymous. And I think that's probably the writer's condition. It's also one of the subjects of the book, which is that a writer writes the books. I write the books. I'm in the book here, and I try to pick up a woman, and she won't look at me. She says she's not interested, but we're in her house, and she's kind of sends me away. And before I leave, I see a shelf of books, and I wrote them. I've given her a false name. And she says, I said, "What about this guy?" She said, "Paul Theroux, I love him. I love," she says it to my face, "I love him." And I think all I have to do is say, "I'm Paul Theroux," and I get to spend a weekend with her, I suppose. I don't know. Suddenly I'd be transformed in her eyes. So it is, that's the separate selves that I guess I'm writing about.
Your resistance to the term meditation interests me because I'm in favor of it. What seems to me to be the great virtue of your writing. You mentioned, for instance, at one point Frederick Dürrenmatt, the German writer, but at another point Robert Louis Stevenson. And it seems that although they could be said to share certain themes in common, the lost double, the seeking for a missing self, that Robert Louis Stevenson is a writer in the American-English vein of adventure and a great popularizer of what in other hands become esoteric and metaphysical themes. And it seems that your writing as well surprises, because if you expect to be finding a travel book with a lot of adventure and sex, you're shocked to find the meditative qualities. And if vice versa, you come to think, oh, well, this book really, how odd, this is a prolonged ghost story. And the ghost is the author himself, sometimes being tracked by the author himself. You're surprised by how corporeal it is and how sexual.
Yes, well, these are what you're saying interests me a lot because, well, for one thing, I very rarely get into this territory with interviewers who usually say, "What country do you think my wife and I should travel in?" and then other people say how rude I am. I'm in my travel books that I'm very rude about people and I make jokes at their expense and I'm not politically correct. So people deal with my books in a political way rather than in the aesthetic way that you're referring to them. I think the whole subject of the double is, I would have said that there's the whole middle period of my writing. I think I'm coming to the end of it. I hope I am, because for many years I could think about nothing mm-hmm. else, because I felt so like a double myself, as if there was this person writing the books and there's this other person who, you know, the heavy bear who goes with me, that who I like to paddle kayaks, I like to go snorkeling, I like to drink, I like to travel, I like to look around, just mooch around, I like to hike, I like to ride a bike. I like to do, I've owned a gun since I was 10 years old, not to kill animals, just target shooting. But I have so many punk, non-intellectual, ridiculous pursuits. And then there's this other person who not another person really, but there's this essence inside me, which is writing the books. I never ever thought that I became a writer because of any intellectual gifts. I always felt that there was some dysfunction or something inadequate, some void that I was filling, you know?
Well, but for the moment, I would like to speak to the author who begins this book with an epigraph from Borges, who includes a visit off the cuff from Anthony Burgess, who's dealing with the London literary scene and its odd procedures, who is being haunted by lepers who seem to be calling on the phone announcing Paul Theroux is dead, who are bringing the cargo of the literary supernatural to bear on this theme of loss and divorce, loss of love, distance from others. It does, I think you're playing in making it sound like an unliterary book, or perhaps I'm playing and insisting that it is, but it does have a very obsessive cargo of the search for the lost self.
No, that's true. It is a literary book. It's a book about a writer. It's a book about writing. It's a book about the strange paradox of being a writer, of being Anthony Burgess. Anthony Burgess meets his greatest fan, this man Letfish, who collects his books. Burgess happens to be drunk and animadverting on every subject. And it's sort of insulting. And the man looks at him and thinks, "Who this drunken Anthony Burgess talking about food and stumbling around with food stains on his tie, is he the writer?" I mean, I think that a writer is an enchanter. It's a shaman. A writer is a shaman, magic, a priest, or has almost a priest-like function. I believe in all of that. But we don't always look like shamanskis. We look like I don't know, just everybody else. And I think that's rather paradoxical. I think this book, My Other Life, is about the nature of writing and the nature of reading, because reading is as creative, as challenging, as amazing a task or an experience as writing is. This is why there are so few readers. Very few people read. Very few people read in a passionate, creative way. When I'm in bookstores or giving talks around the country, I always feel like John the Baptist, someone talking to early Christians. A lot of people huddled in a bookstore, people huddle together, and it's not a lot of people. I mean, even if you get 500 people or 1,000 people, how many is that compared to the number of people who should be reading? So it's kind of odd. It's as though writing is, and I do think that writing and reading is an activity that's confined to just a minority of people, very, very few people. But the paradoxes of the writing life is something that I wanted to write about in this elusive way that you mentioned, because I've always felt that books about writers are tedious. It's usually a success story. Simple guy, simple woman wants to write a book. People say, "Oh, you're never going to write a book." They think, "I'm going to write my book. I'm working," like whittling a stick. They write the book, it becomes successful. It goes into paperback. Someone makes a film about it, and it's a success, a great success, or it's a failure. You know, I'm going to write a book someday. I'm going to expose this whole thing, and the guy labors in vain about this book, and it comes to a sticky end. But writing isn't like that. Writing, there is an element of magic in it, I also wanted to reinvent my life, to have the second chance that life denies me, because that's what fiction offers. It offers this second chance. I can relive my life. I can quit the job that I always wanted to quit and reconstitute it so that I can actually meet the Queen of England. I can get a different divorce. I can meet a psychopath and almost spend the week with her, you know, the weekend with her, that sort of thing. So that there's, I wanted to be the most readable book about the most complex of issues.
That's why I think in these terms of Robert Louis Stevenson and in part Nabokov, a desire to speak of fairly subtle gradations and distinctions, but at a very popular level.
Well, I think that I've never wanted to be obscure, but I also never wanted to oversimplify. I think one of the problems about talking about writing is that I oversimplify the whole thing. And I think in writing, you can get to grips with it. But this is a book, My Other Life, is a book that I started 10 years ago. And so in the meantime, I wrote Pillars of Hercules. I wrote the book about China and Milroy the Magician. In between, lots of big, fat books. But I had wanted to write variations on a theme using mm-hmm. myself as a character, because I know how I would react to something. I know how I would react, for example, to the offer of a part in a movie, or, as I say, meeting the psychopathic woman, or meeting my double, who is a man of my forerunner, a man who's lived my life before I've finished my. He's lived all my life up to this point. To the point that we meet, but he's older than me, so he's lived longer than me. And what would he say? So that notion is one that totally fascinated me.
It's a very funny idea. In fact, he's written a book or two ahead of you because he is older, and he provides one of the most beautiful moments in the book, a short story of his, your double, called Champagne, right. Which is a story that Paul Theroux has not yet written, but his German double has. It has been published in translation in an anthology. He finds the pages are squared within My Other Life, an inset story, like something found in the Arabian Nights, and it is the version, the only version we get, essentially, of the last meeting of this husband and this wife, beautifully rendered. The saddest story I ever read, says Paul Theroux at its close.
It was, sad story, because I was thinking, it's a story, it looks like a celebration. You think, what are these people doing? They're celebrating something, drinking champagne, they're going out for this meal, special meal, the wife's a bit late, and they go a bit breathless. And at various points, they become upset, tearful at one point, at memories, and they're talking about the past. It's all about the past, all about the past, all about the past. The way people do when they're celebrating an anniversary or something, except that you realize at the end of the story, I'm laughing. Why am I laughing? That this is the last meal they're ever going to have together. That the next morning they separate. And I thought it's amazing. It's like the last. Supper, this last meal that an executed person eats. It is a sad story. It's a terrible story. I find it a very upsetting story in some respects, myself, when I wrote it.
Well,
so there you are.
One of the most satisfying moments in the book comes when a woman says to the Paul Theroux of the book, well, you're a very nice man. And he thinks to himself, no, I'm not. I'm not. And I wouldn't have written the things that I've written if I were. And one of the pleasures about reading fiction is that encountering of the truth, whereby people are not very nice, encounters with strangers may be rude, and the encounterer may be rude in the aftermath when he sits down to the page. But the book seems to be a record perhaps analyzing or anatomizing the possibility that if one were to meet oneself, one would be every bit as aloof as one has felt one is from anyone else.
Mm. Yes, and I think that may be the uneasy relationship that the writer has with his or her other self, which is that I think that, I mean, your word meditation does jar me a little because I think of meditation as a very amorphous thing and dull. I think of it as dull. But I don't. But I do think that, that there is a meditative state that a writer gets into when they're sitting at a desk working. And it's the only state to be in. It can't. You can't live your life as a writer. I mean, I'm 55 years old. I've written 30-odd books. But it's impossible to write a lot or to continue to write if you haven't developed a method for it, if you haven't developed a discipline for it in a way of just putting your bum on a chair every day and doing it. It's simply impossible. And to do that, I suppose there's a zen of it. There is a meditative side of it. But that's not the same side that the same mood that one is in when one's with one's children or out in a restaurant or God knows, you know, taking a train through Siberia. It's a different, I think it's a different activity.
No, I think you were quite right when you, I take it proposed as an alternative variations on a theme rather than meditation, and I see the difference. What interested me, though, was the thoroughness with which the possibilities are pursued here.
Hmm.
Meeting a character from one's work, meeting an author who with whom one has certain things in common but others not, meeting another man who's in the process of divorcing his wife, meeting still another man who's married the woman that one once dated. There's a kind of rigorous tracking down, not of anything concrete, but of a net, a nimbus, an atmosphere of self-examination.
Meeting these people, the ex-husband of one's ex-girlfriend, the notion of quitting a job, that the episode of meeting a psychotic, being in a leper colony, having a crazy uncle, being tempted by a woman, sort of the embodiment of London. All of these, you know, when you were listing them, I was thinking, there's a strong element of desire and fear in all of these things. These are fantasies. They're my fantasies, my fears, my desires. And I think that I wanted to, using my own natural reactions would have been to hypothesize these people in my life. And it's a way of living a very, very intense existence, because I have written about my life constantly, even though people say, well, this is an autobiographical book. Well, of course it is, but what isn't? What isn't autobiographical?
But, Paul, you're so interesting here because, in fact, you say having a crazy uncle, when the point is that it's having a crazy uncle who publishes a novel in which he is not crazy at all. Mm-hmm. You say meeting a psychopath, when the point is this is a woman who loves to read and has shelves and shelves of books and is talking about the satisfaction she finds in her books when she's thoroughly dissatisfied with her life. And so you are dissimulating a bit by saying crazy uncle as opposed to knowing the crazy side of someone who in writing is quite astute.
Absolutely. The man is a writer. Everyone in the book is involved in reading or writing. Everyone. Or collecting books or something. So it's true. Yeah, the point is about the crazy uncle is the crazy uncle isn't crazy. He's the most eccentric man you could ever want to meet. But it turns out that his book is a masterpiece of sanity and elegance.
Now, let me propose something here. I once met a teacher of mine, in fact, who had started to call home to see if he was home. He would call up and wait for someone to answer, and no one answered. I was very interested in this.
Who wouldn't be?
Yes, and he had just broken up with a girlfriend about whom he had perhaps his first ideas of being married. And so the person who was supposed to be home answering the phone was, of course, not there. he told me that he used to go to the mirror expecting not to see himself, or picked up his mail from his mailbox and saw the name on the letters and wouldn't recognize it as his own. So I asked the doctor, well, what's this? And he said, well, you know, when someone is going through a separation, autoscopic hallucination is the central characteristic. One has fantasies about the appearance or disappearance of the self. Mm-hmm. And that this book is the writer's equivalent to every kind of autoscopic fantasy that this writer, Paul Theroux, my guest, can devise. It is, as he says, an attempt to use fiction to pull oneself up out of the pit of what would otherwise be a form of hallucination that leaves one mind-boggled.
Or a dissociated personality. I suppose, yes, that's true. There's a bit where I write letters, Dear Paul, how are you? Best wishes, Paul. And writing letters to myself, but as though I'm a different person. Yes, that's definitely true.
Now, at the end of the book, something very moving and eerie happens. The author has begun to think of his life as a half-life. He then presents himself to a psychoanalyst as a studier of particle physics and concerned with half-lives. And eventually, only when he calls his wife and says, I'm divorcing you, his life arrives, the other half of it, in the mail, by shipment. And the last chapter is an inventory of things from the past that are being returned from that marriage as his life magically assembles itself around him again. A kind of moving and at the same time very eerie chapter, because it's a list, essentially, of items. Almost as if, weirdly, the life is settling around as souvenir without its participants in it, as if some version of the life is now without the people.
Hmm. Well, the first, if you call, the Uncle Hal figure in the very first chapter, the prologue, as it were, is someone who's gathered all this flotsam and jetsam around. He's got little gold figures and strange toads. He's got skulls. He's got swords. He's got netsukis. He's got books with tissuey pages. He's got collections of paper and pencils and pens and all sorts of stuff. And so he's got all this paraphernalia. The idea of this magpie mind at work, I think, is something that I saw would be congruent, let's say, with the mind of the characters. And I also thought, what kind of a story can you tell about a list of objects? Just a crate. So you take out a crate. What does it tell, all those objects, tell about the person? Some of the objects you've seen in the preceding chapters, some of them are new. But you know where each one, you can assign a place, a time and a place, and in some cases an incident, to each object. And I suppose it's a whole household moving. It's all the it's the paraphernalia of the writer, but there's no books in it. It's just, I mean, books are mentioned, but it's just a lot of pieces from trips.
That's interesting. You know, in a book full of symmetries, I'd neglected to notice that symmetry.
Just incidental, I suppose. But it's I've always loved reading. And I even wrote a short story based on this, acknowledgments. You read the acknowledgments at the back of a book or sometimes in the front of a book. I'd like to thank the following people and the following places. And then the places they begin to wonder, oh, yeah, I went to British Columbia, I went to Africa, yes, somebody in California, somebody in New England, oh, and special thanks too. And you think, well, what happened? Then they went here, and you see there's a whole history in the acknowledgments of a book, and it usually ends with, I'd like to thank my typist, blah, blah, and most of all to my wife who kept those hot dinners, or my husband who, you know, held my hand. And there's a whole life on the page of acknowledgments, much more on the page of acknowledgments often than you get in the 300 pages that precede it. And I wrote a story with a plot, a story called Acknowledgments, where there's a plot. It's actually a murder story. You can see how something wicked happened. And it's just thanks, you know, and people who looked after me here, there, and everywhere. So I think it's maybe there's a bit of it's something Borges might have done, or but it's because it's a blend of metaphysics and then Conan Doyle, mm-hmm. and it's very satisfying. So I was thinking, try it that way. That's why. So the last chapter in the book is just artifacts, just you know,
well,
a list of stuff.
That is the fun to me. For me, for some reason, I see you as being a descendant of a certain kind of Edwardian writing characterized for me by Stevenson and Doyle and Kipling. Certainly colonialism has something to do with it, but the literary enterprise as something to astonish and entertain and amaze, that being a writer at that stage of the world was something that someone knew how to be. It wasn't being discovered. And so now these writers were becoming dexterous at it. They were becoming polymaths and, as you were saying before, enchanters. And what seems to happen here in my other life is that Paul Theroux, the man who has taken people on so many tours of South America, of other continents, is now, and probably who's heard people saying, "You've taken me so many places, Paul," is now taking the reader, who is imagined to be somewhat unwilling, on a guided tour of the last moments of a recently unhappy life. Mm-hmm. You want to ride with me? Okay.
We can call it. It's the inner journey. That's right. It's the inner journey rather than the outer journey. Because it's not a lot of trouble to write a book about China. You just get on a lot of different trains, or India for that matter. Africa is a bit of a problem. But in general, you're out, you're actively looking for a narrative. This is something else. This is living a narrative, and then it's finding a parallel narrative, because I suppose I could write about my life perfectly well, but I would be bored stiff if I were merely writing about my life. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to write a what if. What if my life had been slightly different? And also, what is the nature of the writer anyway? How separate is he or she? How strange is it? And how odd it is, you know, to be a writer. As I say, I think of writers as completely invisible people. We don't have faces. We don't have personalities even. We live in our books. Apart from that, we're nobody.
I've been speaking to Paul Theroux, the author most recently of My Other Life. Thank you for joining me.
My pleasure.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Jennifer Swadek. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now with Book of the Mouse Club Time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.